I was thinking earlier of many years ago when we used to handwrite New Year cards and greetings to everyone. And there used to be stacks and stacks of envelopes that we would have to stamp, write the addresses, and then send these New Year greetings a few weeks in advance, hoping that it'll reach in time. And then after that, of course, the internet started, and we could write one letter greeting and sending our New Year wishes to everybody. And that seemed also a far more simpler thing to do. And now, I think with the modernization of technology and the new inventions that come, of course, one of the things that is happening is it is making us all more and more lazy. So this year, even more easier than writing a letter to everyone, I thought, why don't I just use my mouth and take advantage of the modern technology? All my very clever computer friends tell me how to begin using it a lot more. So here it is. And I think this is a very nice way and very easy way to send our greetings. But of course, our greetings for the new year is very heartfelt, and everyone joins me in wishing everyone a wonderful 2012, the very famous year coming in. So recently, we've been receiving a lot of questions whether this is going to be a difficult year or a kind of a catastrophic year, or whether something drastic is going to happen, and so forth. And I don't know. The record of the last few years hasn't been very good, but at the same time, from a Buddhist perspective, I don't think it is going to be as catastrophic as many people have said, because the joint karma of sentient beings and the world in general, being difficult, and we are, of course, entering into a very difficult phase in our lives. The world is itself entering into a very difficult phase. But again, speaking from a practice perspective, think there is much power in prayers, much power in basic goodness of all human beings, and a lot of goodness that is still very strong among many, many people. And the blessings, of course, of all our teachers and the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas will continually prevail and will continually protect all sentient beings. So, of course, as in every year, I think we can look forward to a lot of good things happening, a lot of challenges that we are going to face, but working with hope, working with more optimistic hope that better sense will prevail, our leaders, global leaders, all our people and people of various powers and positions will allow basic goodness to be more strong within themselves, and that will continually bring forth greater inspiration for all of us to cultivate goodness, to cultivate virtue, so that it will strengthen the environment, that it will strengthen the elements, and it will strengthen basic goodness inherent of every human being individually, and inspire others to follow that example. So it is with that wishes that I would like to give all our love and all our good wishes for the coming year. Of course, there is no particular celebration of any kind this new year, as well as in the coming Tibetan New Year, because as many of you know, we've lost so many wonderful people this year. Sangha members have lost many, many loved ones this year. And a steady request for names, for prayers for loved ones, whether they are facing challenges or many of you who have lost people have come in with the offerings. And Lotus Garden residents, resident manager Lisa has sent them here. I have, previously our nuns went to some of the sacred places in Nepal to make the offerings, as well as include those offerings in the Parinirvana ceremony of Chöpche Trishi Rinpoche. And then the second, and since then, all the offerings, as well as requests for the prayers, the names have been gathered and the offerings have been sent to the Kalachakra that is happening in Bodh Gaya beginning from tomorrow. as well as will be added to the Nyingmamonlam, the great gathering of many, many teachers, monks and nuns that will be coming up in about another 2-3 weeks. So looking at the number of people that are there who have faced these challenges, loved ones who have passed away, and for Mendrolling particularly, it has been a very sad year. We lost Jabje Trushik Rinpoche, who's incomparable kindness to all Nyingma practitioners, all Dharma practitioners, and particularly to Mendrolling, is something that is unparalleled. And just as we were very lost and felt the physical absence of Jabje Mendrolling Trichin Rinpoche in 2008, likewise, we feel that with the passing of Trichin Rinpoche. And then just a few days ago, another great master of Nyingma's, Dongse Chunle Norbu Rinpoche, passed away. And Jabje Dongse Rinpoche, Chunle Norbu, as many of you refer to, was also another great, great good friend of His Holiness Mendrolling Trichin Rinpoche. He studied and grew up together. They were of the same age. Then Trichin Norbu Rinpoche lived in Mendrolling for over 9 years studying. And then when Jabje Mendrolling Trichin Rinpoche came to India as a refugee, both of them spent considerable time together. And both of them had, you know, shared many visions of how the Dhamma could be spread, could be preserved, and their contribution to making sure that the genuine Dharma continue has been of great, you know, contribution and great inspiration for many, many hundreds and thousands of Dharma practitioners. And so Jabje Trichin Norbu Rinpoche also passed away this year. So that's another great loss for all of us, especially for Mendrolling. My great grand aunt, Rinpoche's grand aunt, Jitun Dechen Wangmo, also passed away. And so, for all these reasons, then of course there are no celebrations. But human life, impermanence is there, and human life continues to move on. So, with all these great teachers passing away, with the very few ones who are left, also growing older, every time such a thing happens, I think it inspires us to really persevere harder in trying to understand and benefit from the understanding of the preciousness of the teachings and the Dharma. When such things happen, then it inspires us to work harder in our own Dharma practitioners, Dharma practices. I have always said that practitioners today, Easterners and Westerners, of course there are always many people who face different kinds of challenges. There are years when someone's devotion falters. There are times when practices become very boring. Sometimes people don't find their heart connection to a certain practice. Some people simply allow, I think, mundane samsaric busyness to become more strong and sort of lead them to more towards the busyness of life. And in that way becomes a little bit careless about one's own practice. So those challenges are always, of course, there. But as I have said, there are today, I think, greater interest in Dharma. And all of the many different practitioners that I have met, come across, one of the most remarkable things that I've heard is people love to practice, people like to meditate. People understand the profoundness and the value of Dharma in their life. Of course, some people do more and some people do less. But as far as knowing that it is something that is to be treasured, it is something that is truly valuable, I think there's immense amount of interest, immense amount of faith and trust. And that leads us to a point where we can, I think, very surely say that there are people practice the Dharma with great diligence and devotion. However, something that one often encounters is the importance given to an intellectual understanding of the view, and then thinking that the belief or forcing yourself to believe in that view to being true and profound is sufficient. So take, for example, when you receive teachings, when you understand, when you reflect a little bit on those teachings, it's very easy to think, oh yes, this is true, this is something that is very right, this is something that I need to cultivate. So that's the belief that comes up. And then we sort of let that hang. And we say, okay, I believe. The belief may not be so strong that I'm willing to go through an entire transformation, a transformation that allows me to give up negativities and neuroses and really delve without any hesitation into emulating whatever the view presents, whatever the teachings present. So there is a point where we have a belief, but the belief is still very unripe. And so the belief is there, and we think, as long as I hold on to that belief, maybe someday in the future something will happen when the view itself will become so overpoweringly mature and fruitioned that without much effort, the transition and the transformation that the teachings require will happen. But the waiting period is very long, and so what happens is, we adhere a belief half-heartedly. We understand the view intellectually, but we are unable to really cultivate the view in all its aspects in our life. And so gradually what happens is many different things come in between. Mundane habitual patterns continue to be very strong. And sometimes that acts as a hindrance. Sometimes distractions, whether chosen or sometimes influenced by the force of karma, becomes the distraction. The belief, the faith itself, becomes weaker and one easily forgets. And that becomes a distraction. So there are all of these many different possibilities of disturbances or distractions that can happen, which again doesn't allow our belief to fully fruition as total confidence. Now, because of that, what happens is we become quite religious. We become very, very devoted to the idea of what Dharma is. But we don't necessarily let that Dharma completely sort of permeate throughout our beings. And so that's often referred to as where the distance between view and action comes into place. And so I have been thinking, that why is it that we've become so very dedicated to our practices, and we also have a belief of what the Dharma teaches, the view is something that we believe in. But at the same time, why does it become so very challenging to go through the process of change and transformation that is required in the path of practice? And so, of course, when we think about this, we come into two very important aspects of Buddha Dharma, and that is relative and the absolute. Like the two wheels of a bicycle, or you take any one cart and it has two wheels. Now, imagine if both the wheels are moving together, it's able to carry the weight, it's able to move forward, and oxen or whoever is pulling it can easily take it to its required destination. But if one of the wheels is broken and you have only one wheel, then no matter how much you try and attempt, you'll still have tremendous difficulty in moving the cart ahead, in actually driving the cart ahead. So it is quite like that. In Buddhism, we talk very often about relative truth and the absolute truth. But somehow, when we really try to listen to the teachings and cultivate it in our practices, we often forget the balance of both of these two truths, the relative and the absolute. Very oftentimes, the view takes on such an sort of an immense force towards the absolute that we begin to have a much more sort of an intellectual grasp of what the absolute truth of the Dharma and the view of the Dharma is trying to present us. But the importance of the balance that relative truth must bring is something that we become very careless in. So what happens is our belief in Buddhism is about absolute truth of selflessness, absolute truth of genuine compassion, which is our basic nature, absolute truth of enlightened mind, absolute truth of emptiness. Now when we look at that view that we believe in, and how much of that belief is present in the way we relate to things, how much of that view are we able to bring in into our relationships, into what our likes and dislikes are? Are we even allowed to have that likes and dislikes? So what happens is, because the very profound absolute view is something that is our belief, finds a very uncomfortable state in our relative living. And when the relative living doesn't revolve around much presenting the absolute view, then we become very guilty. We become very self-deprecating, and we blame ourselves. And that is what many people do, is we consider ourselves to be hopeless students, very bad students, lazy students, or not being wise or not being clever or very stubborn or full of negativities. And so that then again builds up the guilt, builds up the regret. And you know, whenever challenges of trying to practice come up, then this kind of a thought pattern of hopelessness, of self-deprecation, does very well in telling us that we will not succeed, that it's better not to go ahead, that you should have self-doubt. And I think that hinders whatever little progresses that we are able to make. So it is very important, therefore, I think, for practitioners, that when you are studying the Dharma so much, and so much of the view is what is being cultivated, and many of you know a lot about the truth of emptiness and what enlightened mind is, nature is, and you are meditating and you're trying to learn all of these different practices, especially if you are in retreat, for example, if you're trying to do your mantra practices and you're trying to really understand the four reminders and realize your own inherent Buddha nature, if you're doing the four foundations and or the four foundations of mindfulnesses and practicing shamatha and vipassana, many of you are practicing Maha Mudra and Dzogchen practices, creation and completion stages. So in all of these practices, while you're working with a very fundamental absolute view, it's always very important that you support that with correct relative view also, a view appreciating the relative teachings. So as we go into a new year and try to begin fresh again with greater enthusiasm and optimism, I would like to encourage everyone to begin working with cultivating certain what are called jewels or adorning qualities. In the East, for example, whenever a new year comes, one of the sort of the common greetings that we send to the others is a prayer of auspiciousness, prayer of success, prayer of good health and good wealth. I remember, as I said, many years ago when we used to write cards and send it to many different people, this was much before I had begun to relate with the Western Sangha or the Western practitioners, we used to write something that was very Eastern on the card. Happy New Year. We all pray for your good health, happiness, and success. Or we used to write, we pray and send you good wishes for a long life, wealth, and happiness. And as I grew older and as I began to speak with Westerners more, many of the Westerners would ask me, why does a monastery send good wishes for wealth? Why does Easterners place so much of emphasis on prosperity? Of course, nowadays I think some say it and some don't say it, but who doesn't like prosperity? Who doesn't like wealth? Everybody is working hard to acquire wealth. However, I thought using, however, that wealth word would be interesting this year. So I'm going to wish you all good wealth. May everyone acquire tremendous wealth. Now, wealth is an English word. And wealth, what do we mean by wealth? In Tibetan is nur, we say nur. Nur directly or just simply translated is wealth, but nur is also another word for something very precious like the jewels. And so may all of you have good health and acquire tremendous wealth. Not only money, the very simple thing that comes into our mind in terms of wealth, but particularly work with cultivating what I'm referring to as the 12 wealths, the 12 kinds of wealth. So, of course, as the year passes, I think this list is going to grow longer. It's not going to be just 12. I started off by saying 7. Then I went up to being 10, and I think I'll stop at 12 because I thought maybe one should match it up with 12 months. But, if it happens to be more, we can come up with some other kind of similar numbers. But in giving it thought, I think, how can one incorporate certain good qualities in life, certain riches in one's own life, that could enhance our view, that would support our devotion to the path of Dharma, so that that support would allow the fruitioning of our aspiration of enlightenment for the benefit of self and the others, with lesser challenges, with lesser hindrances, and with greater speed. I think if one does spend time in trying to work hard, in persevering, in acquiring these tremendously beneficial qualities in life, I think it will be helpful, because these are not just something that I have come up with as a composition, but it is something that we've learned from our teachers, observing them, receiving teachings from them, and trying to observe and learn from their examples on how they live their life, which allows us to then bring a certain kind of a meaning of the Dharma more intimately within our own self, so that everything just doesn't remain an intellectual pursuit, an outer pursuit. So these 12 wealths that I encourage everyone to cultivate, I think the first is the wealth of Dharma, to spend time in understanding how important Dharma is, how precious Dharma is. There's nothing that is actually more precious than the Dharma. We defend samsara, particularly we try to, whenever obligations and responsibilities come up, whenever the mind feels a little bit of resistance to totally letting go of self-absorption and self-attachment, we immediately come up with kind of a sort of a natural defensiveness, and we think we have to champion samsara. So we say, okay, but certain things in samsara are important, samsara has certain qualities. One of the famous things we come up with and say, if there's no samsara, there would be no nirvana, or something very intelligent like that. But if one spends a little bit of time and really thinks very carefully and uses one's own true analysis and observation, It's not very difficult to see samsara as nothing but a quagmire. And sooner or later, the more we indulge in it, we will sink in it. Also, you know, I'm not talking about abandon samsara to cultivate Dharma. I'm not talking about that. But at the same time, if one is aware of the preciousness of the Dharma, one will understand the importance of slowly decreasing, letting go, particularly of those things that are within samsara, which induces and increases self-absorption, self-attachment. Wherever there is great self-indulgence, that person will always have difficulty in having sympathy, empathy, kindness, genuine love, and the ability to let go of grasping and clinging. If one is a practitioner and one truly values the path of liberation and sees that as ultimate happiness, then it will not be difficult for that person to let go of all those distractions and understand the importance of realization and that which cannot happen until we begin to decrease samsaric neurotic patterns and treasure Dharma in our lives. So cultivating wealth of Dharma. Cultivate wealth of Dharma. Dharma, as many of you know, simply means the truth. Every single day, taking small but important steps towards gaining strengthened practice, leading to true seeing, is very important. Take small steps. Don't try everything at once. But just as you sort of gather 50 cents, a dollar, $15, $10, and you go to the bank and you religiously make deposits and so forth. In the same way, every day, gain some strengthened momentum in one's practice until you understand Dharma means seeing the truth as it is, not with tainted-ness, not seeing all the illusions as real, not seeing from a neurotic emotional mind, sentimental mind. But gaining the wealth of Dharma is gaining the strength to see things as it is true, as it is truly there. Even if it is for a fleeting moment, work hard to acquire that wealth of seeing things as it is. Because when you know how things really are, letting go is so much more easier. Doing the right thing will always be so much easier. Cultivating the wealth of Dharma means taming one's own mind. Remember, one may attempt to learn, to meditate, to practice many things, but nothing is gained until one tames one's own mind. So as our teachers say, tame one's own mind and you have gained the wealth of Dharma. So, as the year unfolds, you will hear many teachings, you will read many books, you will sit in meditation, and all of these are wonderful, they're very good. But make sure that in doing all of these many different things, that you are able to treasure the wealth of Dharma. Seeing things as they are, taming one's own mind, and when that is done, you'll become wealthy with Dharma. Just as much as this first wealth is important, the second I encourage is to work with acquiring the wealth of good health. Being a practitioner, sometimes I think people neglect their health. So good health is very important. Good health is an expression of recognizing the preciousness of human existence. Know that good health comes from a serene mind and healthy habits. You may have received many teachings and know a lot about the many different philosophies of Dharma. You know, your belief, intellectual belief of the view might be quite profound. But despite that knowledge, despite knowing it, if it doesn't reflect in your treasuring of your precious human existence because of bad habits, whether it is drugs, whether it is smoking, whether it is alcohol, or other things such as being angry, being very oppressive, being self-destructive, living in great depression, you know, disappointment, not being able to trust one another, laziness, you know, all of those negative habits are not being able to cultivate good habits that protect life, because mentally the mind loses its serenity and its calmness. That affects your body also. So good health is very important. Few things that are very important, I think, to have good health is to eat balanced diet. Learn to really work with your breath. Breathe deeply, inhale and exhale. Learn to work with taming and training one's own breathing so that it allows the mind to have the most beautiful support of sort of calming down and resting as much as possible in its own nature. Meditate, learn to meditate. Cultivate moderation in life, live moderately. Be cheerful. For good health, to be cheerful is very important. Even sometimes when that cheerfulness has to be a little bit forced. But, you know, like every medicine that has to be taken with some kind of discipline, cultivate cheerfulness. Maintain an interest in life. Make an effort to be kind and helpful to the others. If you want to be healthy, be helpful to the others. Especially try to be kind and helpful to the others, but be free from sort of hidden agendas and expectations. If you go out to help somebody else and yet you have a hidden agenda or you have an expectation, that help could ruin your health rather than, you know, build something positive in yourself. One of the secrets of good life is to find joy in silence and solitude. Learn to do that, especially as you grow older. Learn to be happy in silence and solitude. One of the remarkable things that you will find in our teachers, and I think which is a secret of, you know, their sort of good health, is to cultivate a childlike, you know, joyfulness in sort of being curious. You know, there's a sort of a discovery that they make of simple things. Especially great teachers, I've observed that in my teachers, is that these are enlightened minds. Yet in very simple and small things, they have this very childlike curiosity. They take an avid interest. And yet, at the same time, this wonderful childlike curiosity of theirs is without any kind of, you know, unnecessary profoundness or any kind of a stickiness to it. It's just pure joy. And from that pure joy, there's simplicity, there's sort of great happiness, laughter. And I think that really stimulates good health and, you know, it helps your system to really be healthy. So as much as possible, cultivate these good, I think, qualities to building a good and healthy life. And if you are healthy, mind is healthy, physically you are healthy, then it's a good vessel. It's a good vessel within which the view of the Dharma can manifest, I think, with lesser obstacles and hindrances. Third wealth I think that one must try to cultivate and learn about is the wealth of success. Now, what is success? Because, you know, when you are a spiritual person and a practitioner, very oftentimes you also live with the stereotype kind of a title of not being successful in life. So what does success actually mean? So be successful, but understand what success is. From the Dharma perspective, the wealth of success comes from the power of decisiveness. You know, being decisive. You make a decision and you remain firm and steady and patient with that decision. That is going to lead you to success. Wealth of success comes from decisiveness and having a simple outlook to things. One must learn to be steadfast, patient, and firm with one's decisions, and be victorious, successful in any action that one undertakes. And it doesn't matter whether that what you have undertaken is something very big or something very small. To have this wealth, to have the wealth of success, never begin something with a thought, what if this doesn't work? Because if one has this kind of attitude, even before you begin something, then one ends up only planning. If one begins everything assuming this won't work, or you're not content with what you have begun, you do things, but you do them half-heartedly, begin something, and then you have, you know, other thoughts. You're fully inspired to do something in the daytime, you go to bed, you have second thoughts. What happens with all this kind of an attitude is you become only a planner. You become very good at planning things. You don't become good at carrying things to fruition. One only ends up thinking, 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 worrying, and worrying. And nothing is accomplished. Life finishes, and nothing actually good or substantially beneficial for self and others is acquired. Success is not about just becoming rich or famous, having a title, you know, or something like that. Success is seeing through to completion whatever it is that you are doing, and to be joyful in what you are doing. Even if it is sweeping the floor, even if it is washing the dishes. Do it well, do it joyfully, see it to completion. Do it without an agenda. Do it because, you know, you're able to accomplish it, and find the joy of success, the wealth of success, in having that attitude in life. So success must be understood as doing your best regardless of the result, because it trains, having that attitude towards success trains our mind to be free from hope, from expectations, and the trappings of, you know, all the material things that are there. Some people are there who, you know, do simple things, but they do it with steadfast interest, see it to completion, and finds great joy in doing this. And this could be simple things like, you know, planting a tree or making a meal. And then if your attitude to big or small things remains really in this way, then you have the glow of success in your life. So the third wealth No matter what you have undertaken, what you are doing, try to do it successfully and gather the wealth of success in life. Fourth, I think, quality that many of us as practitioners need to cultivate is to develop the wealth of courage. You know, we very oftentimes, you know, we've spoken about building confidence, being brave, cultivating courage, and so forth. So what is courage? No, there are many different ways to approach the topic of courage and to try and see what it is. But courage, one way of looking at courage is being, you know, able to be without all the different kinds of fears that we have. For example, being afraid of not being successful. Look at the fear first. To be brave, to be courageous, first look at the attitude that one has. Does one have the attitude of being afraid of not being successful? You haven't even started something, but you're just afraid of not being successful. Being afraid of committing, being afraid of making mistakes, being afraid of making a fresh start or beginning fresh. Every time you're told to start again, let's take Yantro for example. And if a teacher says, why don't you start from the beginning? People almost think that that's a sign of a failure. You don't see it as, you know, maturing more beautifully, because you're able to make a fresh start. But that fresh doesn't have to mean you failed at something before. So then that's about the attitude. So observe and see the attitude that one has that is afraid of making a fresh beginning. Then another sign of lack of courage is being afraid to letting the past be. You know, sort of just chasing after the, keep thinking about the past, too afraid to let the past be. Being afraid to doing anything, being afraid of breaking free from habitual patterns. You know, that's another tendency that really builds lacking in courage. For one to truly be able to manifest the view of the Dharma, how will you do that if one is not courageous enough to break free from habitual patterns, and to keep persevering in working towards decreasing of, you know, habitual tendencies and so forth. So these negative tendencies, when they are let be, when you let go of these attitudes, you're freed of these attitudes, that is then gaining the wealth of courage. Because when people lack courage, people lack happiness. Even before beginning something, if you started off with, will I succeed? Will I win? What will others think? Should I? Shouldn't I? What if this happens? What if that happens? Then there are just too many namtoks. There are too many discursive hesitations and doubts, which truly is going to lead a person to lack completely in courage. And when that courage is missing, when the wealth of courage is missing in life, transformation and transition from negativities to positive qualities is going to be very, very difficult. From samsara to nirvana, that transition will become very, very difficult, because the timidity of your own attitude will always be a great obstacle. Now these days, this is more enhanced, where especially the younger generation, I think everyone, but especially the younger generation, where, you know, there's an unfortunate trait where people have become very careless about looking into themselves, examining oneself from within, and beginning to know yourself better, and take that as the reference of trying to build a better person, trying to work with oneself. Instead of doing this, one has begun to place tremendous importance in presenting an image of oneself based on the expectations of the others and the opinions of the others, peer pressure or friends' opinion or whatever is in vogue in the world today. You know, sort of just an imitation, and trying to imitate has become so important. When one relies on the outer's opinion, the opinion of the outer, not really knowing oneself, then you live in great confusion. Where that confusion becomes more and more, you really do not know your own self. There's a sort of a crisis in identity. And when you don't know your own self, what is it that you're going to work with? For example, when you're a practitioner and you're trying to work with taming the mind, transformation of the self, and if you're not, and if you don't know what it is that you're working with, then everything becomes very pretentious. And so that's why, you know, we behave in certain ways in front of the teacher or in a Sangha environment, and then we relax and revert back to something else in another environment. And so when they, you know, when there's that confusion that continuously persists, then you don't have the strong basis and the awareness of the basis with which you're working. So therefore it's very important to continually know how to work with one's own self. When you work with one's own self, you have greater confidence, you have greater sort of ability to go beyond doubts and hesitations. Sort of certainty arises. And that's the good basis for building courage in one's own self. So courage and confidence is very important. And for that, to be more introspective, to know yourself better, to be able to really look into one's own self. Silence, especially silence, is very important to look into one's own self and to know what it is that your, you know, good qualities are and enhance them. To look at what are those negativities that you're struggling with and to reduce them, to decrease them, to work with the antidotes. Those are things that are very important, and that's a mark of courage in one's own life. Fifth wealth that I'm going to talk about is wealth of friendship. Having a caring attitude, having a sense of belonging, having a flexible attitude that adjusts to all situations easily. Someone who encourages each other on the path of virtue are the signs of friendship, good friends. Particularly what comes to my mind is a quote from the Buddha's teachings in the Sutra where he says, an insincere and a neurotic friend is to be feared more than a wild beast. A wild beast may wound your body, but an evil friend will wound your mind. And that's very, very true. Sangha consists of many good friends. And you have to learn to be a good friend and learn to have good friends. Friendship requires the friend to be responsible in showing the path to greater sanity, basic awareness, basic sanity. There are people who among friends project their own insecurities and their own neuroses. And I think that's really very, very dangerous. It's very, very harmful. One should keep away from such friends at a time where your mind is not so strong in the view and the actions being, you know, completely inseparable. There will come a day when you will have enough confidence of the view that you may get, be in the midst of all kinds of, you know, people or in different kinds of environment, and yet it won't be strong enough to influence your mind. But until you are sort of in a fragile state where you get easily influenced, you have to be very careful to avoid those situations where the environment of neurosis makes you even more neurotic. If you are a friend, you have to be able to be really careful that one never projects one's own insecurities and neuroses such that it deviates another person's mind from the path of the Dharma, from the path of the truth. Then there are people who think allowing this to happen to yourself you know, allowing somebody else to making you more neurotic is the sign of being a good friend. And this is also not true. Letting the influence of friends lead you into retaining the worst of the human neuroses is not being a good friend, it's being foolish. So you have to be able to understand what is a good friend and acquire the wealth of friendship. One must learn to first cultivate one's own mind in such a way that you yourself are the most ideal friend. You know, how to look at friendship. You know? So we're not going to say, oh, I'm going to run away from all these friends because they're very neurotic. Before you do that, first work with yourself. You become a good friend. Do not look for a perfect friend, but instead for be oneself, become the perfect friend. And then you will find that the world is not such a lonely place after all. So this year, work with building up friendship. Sixth is the wealth of skill. Now, let me first just go through. What is wealth of skill? Some are good at writing. Some people are good at arguing. That's also a skill. Some are good at music. Some are good at cooking. Some at cleaning. Some may have a good voice. Some have good memorization skill. Some are good administrators. Some can make people laugh. Some can lead well, some can be led well or follow well. Wealth of skill is knowing what is one's skill. One must recognize one's own skill and work with that. Many people don't recognize one's own skill, and instead of trying to build whatever it is that is in you, continue to look at the skill of the others. Have envy at the skill of the others. Try to imitate the skill of the others. And in that way, you never gain the wealth of skill. So that is, you know, when one does not know one's own skill, and one is deprived of the wealth of skill. Skill are of varied kinds, and you must learn to appreciate that. You know, in the traditional analogy, we have the thousand-armed Genrezig. You know, there's this form of Avalokiteshvara Genrezig with a thousand arms. And I remember once Jebje Trigen Rinpoche telling me, you know, what it personifies. Of all the many different symbolisms that are there, he said, skillfulness are the thousand arms of Genrezig. And if you look at that figure, you know, the compassion of Avalokiteshvara, of Genrezig, manifests in the manifold thousand arms. And each arm is part of that one single body of the Bodhisattva. And if you look at the icons, iconography or the pictures, you will find that all of the hands, the thousand arms, are exactly the same. So, you know, none are bigger or smaller, greater importance or lesser importance. So therefore, wealth of skill comes when you know whatever it is that you are able to do. When you do that well, when you do it with genuine happiness and joyfulness, then it truly becomes a source of goodness to others and towards yourself. Even the most simple, trivial of the skills can be a great wealth. One must learn to take joy in whatever smaller and big things one can do well, because that is the wealth of skill. And instead of discovering that and treasuring that, if you spend more time in looking at somebody else's skill and then wanting to do that, you know, oh, you see a wonderful umze and you think, oh, I'd like to do an umze. You know, you cook well. But you know, you think, oh, anyone can cook well, but I'd like to become an umze. And unfortunately, you don't have the voice, or you don't know the liturgy, or you've never done that. So those are, you know, simple things that does happen very often times. I've noticed that where what you could best contribute in is not treasured, and you lose so much time in trying to simply gain the skill of another person. So don't do that. This year, spend time in acquiring the wealth of skill, your own skill. Discover that. Make that beautiful. Make that a source of generosity to the others. Make that a source of happiness to yourself. Be joyful in that and give to the others. In the same way, work hard in acquiring the seventh wealth, the wealth of laughter. You know, I was reading a quote about laughter where the Buddha said, there's a quote where he says, at the height of laughter, the universe is flung into a kaleidoscope of new possibilities. So I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. Where does it say that where you have become a Dhamma practitioner, you have to become so serious in your own profoundness that you lose laughter in life? Then you become so serious, sad and serious, without any laughter, you know. Maybe in the future we will have bodhisattvas who are so profoundly serious that they have forgotten happiness and laughter. And you get pictures of kind of, you know, bodhisattvas, very profound, very serious. I think that's a kind of contradiction to what selflessness is, what enlightenment is, what awakeness is. So it's very important that you don't get lost in the hypocrisies of all the make-beliefs that we have, you know, of all that what we have assumed to be, you know, aspects of mature realization and understanding of the Dharma. But recognize that the more you understand the Dharma, the lighter your heart will be, the less self, you know, grasping, the tightness and the tension will be. And so cultivate laughter in your life, a full, sincere laughter each day, if possible, is very important. Laughter rests always on a mind that has the courage to have some sense of humor about oneself. Taking oneself too seriously, you know, constantly preoccupied by gauging oneself upon the opinions of the others or about yourself, you know, opinions about your own self, being overly ambitious, particularly in being enlightened. Yeah. These are sure reasons why you will lose laughter in life. And then you become very uptight. I've never heard about an uptight bodhisattva or an uptight selfless Buddha. So recognize that. Develop, cultivate loosening up of the self-importance. When you really look at Dharma and the meaning the teachings present, you will find, you know, why do you hold on to that tension? There's nothing to hold on to. And you begin to actually see how foolishly we make things so very serious. Seriously good. Seriously meditating, seriously realizing, seriously listening, you know, all of those seriously doing things. Why do we do them? Whom are we trying to show the seriousness to? You know, if one really is understanding the Dharma, one will find a lot more of the loosening of that tension that comes with the self-importance, a little bit of humor in one's own self, humor about the seriousness that brings attachment, that brings anger, humor about the plannings that we do of the future that might never come, you know, all those different many things that we do, that's really very, you know, laughable, it's very humorous. those are good references to build a good hearty laughter in your own life. And in that laughter, if you can rest a bit, you might find that this might do much better in enhancing your understanding of the practice than any other kind of pretentiousness that we build in our life. Another thing that the Buddha said that comes to my mind is, you know, the Buddha said in one of the sutras, when you realize how perfect everything actually is, you will tilt your head back and laugh at the sky. So keep that in mind. To have laughter, you will need to have the ability to be without criticism. Enjoy simplicity, be beyond competitiveness, keep your mind vast and flexible, and learn to love others and get along with others. Learn to see humor in how seriously we take things and how we revel in complications. You know, especially complications. In sanghas, complications about titles and roles that we play. So when you become very serious about, oh, being a teacher, serious about, you know, being a good meditator, serious about being a chopin, or serious about being, you know, whatever it is, the titles, then learn to really laugh at yourself. And in that laughter, let go. In that laughter, really relax and let go. And you will find that to be tremendously a powerful experience in your practice, in your meditation. Eighth wealth that we could work with in acquiring is the wealth of contentment. We often tend to forget that happiness doesn't come as a result of getting something which we don't have, but rather that happiness comes from recognizing and appreciating what we already have. How many times do we spend really being happy and grateful for all the things that we really have? Versus, how much more do we think we need to have before we actually have happiness? So therefore, one must recognize and take time to appreciate what we already have and to find contentment in that. One must have the wealth of contentment which comes from truly being grateful for all the things that we already have, for all the people in our lives, for all the moments that we have, that we are able to live life, which so many don't enjoy, so many people, so many beings do not have in their life. If you are able to develop a sense of awareness of how many people, how many beings actually suffer tremendously, one would probably be able to have much more contentment in one's own life. Because when one doesn't appreciate what one has, and with dissatisfaction constantly looks outward, such a person loses all peacefulness and happiness in one's own life. Our great teachers have always said, the richest person is a content person. Contentment cannot come to one who is always, you know, gauging oneself against others or depending upon outer things to make oneself a better person. Rather, you know, contentment comes from knowing here and now who one is, to becoming someone who is able to generate unparalleled benefit for self and others. Whoever you are, wherever you are, this moment is actually the best person and the moment from where an inexhaustible amount of goodness can come forth to the others. What hinders that? What usually hinders that is an extraordinarily brilliant idea that we have of doing something more. Something like someone else, a great bodhisattva. You know, we suddenly think, oh, I should become like Shantideva. You know? And that kind of a fantastic plan or a fantastic idea that we have often diminishes the actual potential that you have, which could be, you know, not as great as any great enlightened being's compassion or goodness. But your dog could have a happier, you know, moment in life. Your family members could enjoy you more. You yourself could be genuinely joyful for that moment. And being able to find the wisdom and the goodness in that is to find the wealth of contentment. Where you are content, you will be able to find it to be the best basis from where all goodness, generosity, and compassion and kindness can come for the others. Where there is contentment, such a person is a joyful person. He or she is a person where everyone is happy to be with, is inspiring to the others, and truly you are able to become more available for the others. Where there is no contentment, you're preoccupied to acquire something for yourself. And then when that preoccupation is so big in your life, where do you have the time to think about the others? So build wealth of contentment. This is the eighth. The ninth is the wealth of humility and dignity. Among the Tibetans, there is a kind of a saying that we have, you know, and I read this somewhere also, is that some Tibetans often say somebody, a person who thinks he is better than the others, knows more than the others, believes himself to be, you know, above the others because he's more wiser or capable or learned or whatever it is said to be like a person who is sitting on the highest peak of a very high mountain. And, you know, what's at the peak of a highest mountain? It's very cold there. It's very hard. It's very lonely. And nothing grows there. But if a person puts himself in a lower position, cultivates humility, then such a person is said to be like the one who enjoys living on the fertile plains, fertile land. Humility is a wonderful quality that must be cultivated, particularly by practitioners. I think without intending to, but for whatever many different reasons all of us experience, there's tremendous arrogance, patronizing arrogance, particularly among people who are spiritual practitioners. And therefore, cultivating the wealth of humility is very important. How is one to develop humility? Humility comes with learning to rejoice in the happiness of the others, letting go of one's own ego, appreciating others, developing a wider and a more flexible perspective of life. Humility can arise only in a person who is confident and understands dignity and self-respect. You know, humility is very difficult for somebody who lacks the confidence of working with one's own self. The more learned, the better a practitioner, the more you learn about Dharma, if you really are able to recognize what the Dharma is about, you will always find that that person becomes more simple and more humble. Someone in whom the distance between the view and the actual emulation of the view in one's daily life is, you know, distant, and if there's a gap between the view and the action, you will always find that the person's learnedness does not necessarily lead to the confidence of the view. And because of that gap, you will find insecurity in the person. So you'll always have to be, sort of present yourself and force yourself over the others. That's ego. And so if you look at our great masters, you will find that the more learned, the more realized they are, the more humble they are, the more, you know, in their nature, there is an immense humility, because they are able to have a much more wider perspective of things as they are. It's not always self-oriented. And because of that, you know, they are able to, that humility allows them to really work with the others, work for the others in a much better way. So it's very important that one allows the sense of, you know, ego grasping to decrease it, let go of it, and allow the wealth of humility in one's own life. As much as humility is important, I think dignity is also very, very important. So humility and dignity, both of them go together. Now, what is dignity here? What I mean by dignity is much more the dignity of mind. Dignity means not being self-absorbed. Dignity can only arise in a person who recognizes and trusts basic good nature. True honor, is able to be loyal, you know, that cultivates a certain nobleness, or we could even say an elevation of mind that consists of high sense of right, what is the right thing to do. Someone who is truthful and someone who sort of abhors unkind and evil action. Dignity, someone who has dignity opposes meanness, you know, the sort of mean intention or the wish to hurt somebody else. So someone who is opposed to meanness and develops gentleness in one's attitude and conduct is a person who cultivates dignity of mind. All vices are incompatible with dignity. Someone who injures others or finds one's gain and happiness in the injury of the other, someone who is linear in thought, someone whose linear thought and approach to life makes one so self-oriented, self-indulgent, such a person has no dignity at all. Where that humility and quality of dignity is absent in a person, you know, it'll be very difficult to come out of self and self-absorption, to have the time and the availability to benefit others. Because eventually, as practitioners, when you are meditating, when you're practicing, all these things that you are doing, when you devote your whole life to Dharma, outcome of it, the result of it, is to be of benefit to the others. Ultimately, it's about being truly compassionate, to be able to really generate so much goodness that you're able to share with all the others. What other purpose could there be to enlightenment other than to be of benefit to the others? Now, how will that be ever possible when the ego and the trappings of the ego are so strong that you really can't think beyond the ego itself? So, therefore, to burst the ego, the antidote is humility. But at the same time, in that humility, one must have the dignity. One must have the grace, the dignity, of being able to have confidence as the reference within one's own self, to be free from all negativities, and to be able to really elevate in one's own self, who holds the treasury of Dharma, who is able to, in their own lives, in one's own lives, So cultivate the wealth. Human work with cultivating the 10th wealth, wealth of kindness. When we talk about what is cultivating the wealth of kindness, in Hindi word, there is, you know, one word called swarth. Swarth in Hindi often comes with the word swa and arth. Now, swa means oneself, and arth generally translates as meaning, but what it really means is constantly fulfilling the demands of the self. You know, in English we simply call it selfishness. But spend a little bit of time working with the word swa and arth. You know, whatever you do, whatever you say, whatever you think, if it's constantly being, you know, sort of followed by, how, what can that do to me? How can I fulfill me? What I want? How can I change whatever is happening so that I can benefit from it? If that's the total preoccupation, such a person will never have kindness. To develop the wealth of kindness, you will have to change this attitude to its opposite. Being kind is to think about others. It is said in the teachings, one is poorer than the poorest when everything you do is solely to accomplish something for oneself alone. Such a person knows no joy nor any peace in one's own mind. Think about that. If your entire life is directed towards finding something for yourself, then you are depriving yourself of the wealth of kindness. Where there is no kindness, then there is no meaning to any aspect of Dharma that we are practicing. So if you are meditating, if you are in retreat, if you are practicing, if you are celebrating New Year as a practitioner, if you are supplicating, if you are doing your different kinds of rituals and practices, make sure that each one of them is done to cultivating wealth of kindness. Because if there is kindness, you have Dharma, you have every view correctly, you know, inculcated in yourself. Where kindness is absent, everything that you are doing is being contorted to being just another mundane activity full of self-indulgence. 11th wealth is the wealth of hearing, or wealth of listening, actually. You know, hearing, even in the traditional practice path, is always seen as the gateway to contemplation, meditating, to wisdom, to cultivating kindness, and so forth. One must learn to listen. So many of us spend so much time telling somebody something, speaking somebody, or some of us just outright showing off how much we know. But even among friends, even among Sangha members, you know, someone who can say more is often assumed to be probably more capable or more learned or whatever it is. But one may want to rethink about this. Someone who speaks too much might actually be the most neurotic and the foolish one. Cultivate, learn to cultivate the wealth of listening, the wealth of hearing. Wealth of listening builds awareness. This awareness is then the right basis for any realization, for wisdom, for kindness, and all the good qualities. So acquire the wealth of listening by first learning to listen to the others. Listen to your family. Listen to your loved ones. Listen to the animals. Listen to the changes of nature. Listen to the environment. Listen to the co-workers. Listen to the person sitting next to you. Most importantly, learn to listen to your basic nature. How much time do you spend listening to the very inherent primordial nature? Be able to work with the acquiring, with the building of the wealth of listening. And then the 12th, which I think can simply be called wealth of renunciation. In reading the sutra, the Buddha again says, let go of self and you let go of everything. Now, when we forget this, we try to let go of many things, but we never let go of the self. And so when that happens, then renunciation is never really rightly understood. For us Dhamma practitioners, the whole path is the path of cessation, path of renunciation. And in order to be able to cultivate that, one must have a thorough and a correct understanding of the wealth of renunciation. One must work to cultivating it. Renunciation is not retreating into a self-absorbed solitude. You know, I've heard many people say things like, I'd love to have, you know, be in retreat. I'd love to be able to just be with my practice, you know, to be a renunciate. But that could well be simply retreating into self-absorption. So rather, renunciation is breaking the walls that we have built to divide what is ours, what is self, and what is the others. So therefore, cultivate what the Buddha said. Let go of self and you let go of everything. When such a renunciation, wealth of renunciation is cultivated, then that renunciation, that kind of a renunciation frees us in every way. And there remains nothing but an expansive availability for others. So take some time to think about these 12. If possible, try to, you know, make more, add on to this. What are the different kinds of simple wealth that are there around us, within us, that we need to cultivate, that we need to bring as changes into our lives, which would make this life joyful, a source of happiness to self and others, and also contribute greatly in enhancing our understanding and realization of all the teachings, of all the practices that we do? Are we not ultimately someone who is fortunate in having received so many teachings, the wheel of absolute profound Dharma, but at the same time living very much in a relative world? We have no choice but to find the balance between the relative and the absolute. Whenever we forget chesam, whenever we forget the need to balance both of these, then perhaps what we end up is damaging one or the other. Sometimes the relative world is what we neglect. We neglect the very fundamental responsibilities that we have towards ourselves and to all sentient beings. We forget to cultivating good qualities that could, you know, really bring the view into a blossomed attitude and conduct action in our life. And, you know, sometimes the other extreme of living only in a profound intellectual realm. And then, you know, it is very sad that if all that we end up with, having met with the Dharma, is profound intellectual ideas that doesn't do good for anyone, doesn't do good for self or to the others. So can there be a possibility for us all to wake up to the fact that we are somebody or must in one's own life bring together and enhance this profound view of the Dharma in the form of all the teachings that we have received and we continue to receive. And at the same time, you know, gather all these jewels of good qualities, of sensible qualities in our life, such that the adorning jewels makes more beautiful this vessel within which the profound view can manifest as enlightened mind. So I hope that instead of, you know, many different things, many different ways in which we could spend the coming year, perhaps all of us should begin to look at finding a balance and a union of these two relative qualities and the absolute view together in our own lives. I encourage everyone to do so. Of course, beginning with my own self, I will work hard in trying to work with these, and I encourage everyone to join me in doing so. So I think working and thinking about this may be a good way to say goodbye to the old year and welcome the fresh new year. I would like to now end by giving all good greetings from everyone here, Ani Chunyit, Karma Wazir, Sotram Dechen, and of course our Jetsunla here. Are all the people who are here wishing everyone a Happy New Year to everyone. In India, it's about to be New Year. So as I said earlier, most of us are spending these days in the prayer ceremonies for the Parinirvana celebrations that have been happening. So keeping it very quiet, keeping it a gentle transition from the old to the new year, with all my love, with all good wishes and prayers, I would like to end. But of course, I also wanted to thank every one of you, to Jetsunla, Britain, Nick, Alex, all of you at Lotus Garden who made it possible. Of course, all the residents and all the staff members and volunteers who are making the year-end retreat possible, all the Lopins and the teachers who have taught, who are teaching the in various ways and leading the various programs. Thank you very much. Many New Year greetings are popping up on the screen, so it's very nice to see all of that. So people who are in the various study groups, you have all my love, all my best wishes, and I look forward to seeing you all very, very soon. But until then, take care of yourself, work hard with your practices, be happy in the fortunate circumstance that you all have been born in, be content and see all the goodness that you are surrounded with. And as you go ahead in this year, make it the best reference point for you to become someone who sheds and gives nothing but genuine happiness and inspiration to the others. So, all my love, and bye-bye, everyone.